Welcome to the Media Roundtable. What do we want? Truth and civility. So we're here talking to industry leaders about the state of the media and the way it affects our country so that we as consumers, creators, and sponsors can raise the bar instead of letting it destroy us. And we're going to talk about other things too. I'm your host, Dan Granger. Today we are joined by a man who, it's Bill O'Reilly. How do you introduce Bill O'Reilly? Bill is not only the highest rated cable host in history, he is out with the top New York Times best-selling book, Killing the Mob, which he's going to talk to us about today. That is part of the most successful nonfiction book series in history. And by the way, speaking of history, just yesterday he announced a new history tour he'll be launching this year with none other than Donald Trump. So maybe he'll talk to us about that as well as the state of the media. Welcome to the show, Bill. We're glad you're here.
Dan, thanks for having me in. I appreciate it.
Now, whenever I see a big name that's got a book that they're promoting, I always discount it a little bit. And I had never read anything in the series prior to Killing the Mob. And I got to tell you, I was stunned at the quality of the writing, of the narrative, and of the concept. Because what you've really done is you've taken like the grand finale of every movie and every book and everything we watch about so many notable people that you frame the whole book around that. And I thought that was a very smart strategy from a marketing standpoint, but also a great read. So hats off to you. Let me ask you about the book as it relates to the media. How responsible do you think the media is for sustaining and marketing organized crime in the way that it's been portrayed?
Well, it was interesting you asked me that, Dan. Just today on the No Spin News, which I do on BillO'Reilly.com, we had Steve Sciarippa on, one of the Soprano guys. And I got into the fact with him that that show was so powerful, the Godfather movie, Bonnie and Clyde, these actors are so good, so charismatic, that they make you almost like them and sympathize sometimes with them. And they're heinous people. They're playing heinous people. And that's why I wrote Killing the Mob, because I wanted to get across the quintessential evil of organized crime, how it makes money hurting and killing people and has for centuries, and how it affected all of us in America. All of our lives have been affected by organized crime still today. And so when you see the myth and the fantasy that's put out by Hollywood, and then you really see the reality that I write about in Killing the Mob, it's like a collision course. Boom. And that's why the book has jumped out. It's number one for 3 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. And people are going, you know, I didn't know any of this. I had a different impression of the mob. But after reading my book, you'll have the true impression.
So how hard is it as an author to balance the glamour of the subject matter to keep people interested without condoning the behavior? How hard was that for you?
Well, you got to discipline yourself in anything. I've been successful in my media career in television, radio, and books by basically knowing what the audience will respond to. Doesn't mean I pander to the audience. I don't tell them what they want to hear, but I know what they're interested in. Because I'm one of them. I'm a regular working class guy who has been lucky enough in a great country like America to market my skills and to make a very, very good living. But I'm still one of them. And I know when I get bored, and I don't want to hear pinheads, flight of fancy garbage. I get the facts. It's the old Jack Webb, Dragnet, just the facts, ma'am. I give them to you in an entertaining way, so it's not going to bore you. And that formula has worked for me across all media.
So let's talk about the mafia as it stands today. If there was a GDP for it, if it were measurable, how big a business is it today?
$1 billion business, but it's almost all narcotics. So vice, prostitution, gambling, they don't do that anymore because most states are legalizing that stuff. But narcotics is huge. And what people don't know is that the unlike the French Connection days in the 70s, when the mafia actually handled the product, the heroin or the cocaine, they don't do that now. They franchise it out like McDonald's to drug gangs in individual cities. And these are the people that are causing so much mayhem in a place like Chicago, where these drug gangs fight and kill each other for control of areas where they can sell narcotics. And they have to pay the mafia, the mob, for the right to distribute, because the mob brings the stuff in alliance with the Mexican cartels, the triads in China, things like that. So it's a complicated corporate situation, but billions of dollars still flow into organized crime. And they use that money basically to buy legitimate businesses. That's the profile of the mob today.
Now, one thing I've always been fascinated by is that if you compare underworld activity, mafia activity to legitimate business enterprises, do you think it takes more business acumen or less to operate in the mafia versus a legitimate business and make a
far
dollar?
Far less, because you're basically strong arming people or killing them to do what you want. So, well, you know, if you're legitimate, you can cajole them and at times threaten them. But if you're in organized crime, you basically are pushing a product into an area. And the product is almost always harmful, by the way. And if people don't do what you want, they can get whacked. I mean, yeah. You know, you can.
So you have different levers that you can pull. But I, you know, it's just you have to think, what do we worry about? The FTC, the FCC, you know, they've got a lot of different organizations watching them that they have to make sure that they're dealing with in whatever way they do that. But anyway, fascinating. So you mentioned in another conversation you were having, you see Bobby Kennedy as the hero of the book. Why?
Well, the mob basically came out of the chaos of the Depression. So the organized crime syndicates in America wasn't like Italy, where they had centuries of mafia activity, particularly on the island of Sicily. In America, it was a Depression. The poverty that descended on the country gave rise to these organized bank robbers like John Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde, Babyface Nelson. They didn't, they weren't involved like on day to day, but they were loosely organized. And they went around and created mayhem by stealing from banks. And the people didn't like the banks because the banks were foreclosing. And so the mob had almost a built-in cushion. Then came Prohibition and Al Capone in Chicago, who made a fortune by selling prohibitive alcohol in Cook County in Chicago in Illinois. Now, today, what Al Capone did back in the 30s is the template for how organized crime still operates. And he became very, very powerful. It was short-lived because the Treasury Department got him, not the FBI. But after Capone went down, then the war came in. And then World War II, there was an alliance, if you read Killing the Mob, it's fascinating, between the mafia and Franklin Delano Roosevelt's government. And the mafia helped America defeat Germany. It helped here in the USA, and it helped in Sicily. And because of that, the mob got its tentacles into a lot of places in America that it would not have been able to do. And then J. Edgar Hoover was the main Fed in charge of crime. He was compromised, according to Lucky Luciano, the first godfather. He was the first Don Corleone. They had something on Hoover. Dugard and I, my co-author Martin Dugard and I, couldn't find out exactly what that is. Hoover wouldn't investigate organized crime. And from 1946 to 61, the mob ran wild in America. Controlled the movie industry, the record industry, the hotel industry, the trucking, the unions, you name it. Built Las Vegas from scratch. So it was an enormous accumulation of power. And it didn't stop until Bobby Kennedy was appointed by his brother, JFK, as Attorney General. And Bobby Kennedy went after organized crime with a ferocity, and that's why he is the hero of the book.
So, Bill, on that, and you address this in the book, but I'd like you to explain it here. There was every reason for the Kennedy family not to go after the mob from, sure, as you describe, you know, when Joe Kennedy, who was in the entertainment business and then part of the FDR administration, and then with the help with JFK's election, why would he go against his own family? And what kind of tension did that create?
Well, let me give you a little background. When I was growing up, my father despised Joseph Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedy family, the father. And he says he's a bootlegger. He's a bootlegger. And my grandfather was a cop, a New York City police officer during the Depression and Prohibition. So my father, growing up in that home, they didn't like Joseph Kennedy. Well, he wasn't a bootlegger. He had the concession, if you can believe this, of all the Catholic Church's wine for communion. Joe Kennedy controlled all that. That's how he made his big money during Prohibition, because wine was legal to be sold to the Catholic Church. Anyway, Kennedy had associations with everybody in this country. He knew everybody, including the wise guys and Sam Giancana in Chicago in particular. They dined together. They get down to the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami, mob running at that time. And Joe Kennedy knew them all. So a deal was made in 1960 for Giancana to make sure that John F. Kennedy won the state of Illinois, which Giancana did. So when Kennedy got into the Oval Office, the mob loved this. We have the influence. We have the president. Okay. They didn't have Bobby. Now, I talked to Robert Kennedy Jr., Bobby Kennedy's oldest child, about why would your father go against your grandfather and your uncle? Because it wasn't that JFK was soft on a mob. He just didn't want to hear about it, particularly after organized crime knew that Kennedy's mistress, Judith Exner Campbell, all right, was also the mistress of Sam Giancana. So JFK had some problems there, obviously.
A little conflict of interest.
Right. Now, what RFK Jr. told me, not in a direct way, but I got it from a series of conversations, was that Bobby Kennedy wasn't real bullish on his dad. He always felt a little slighted.
Mm-hmm. And middle child.
Payback.
Yeah.
This was kind of payback.
Makes sense. Okay, so one thing you touch on is the story pretty commonly known about Nixon and Kennedy and the debates and the impact of how Nixon looked at the 1960 debate on television. Now, in 68, wasn't it Roger Ailes that helped him turn that around and make him ready for prime time, so to speak?
Well, at that time, Ailes was a producer of the Mike Douglas Show. And you may remember that Douglas had an afternoon talk show and was fairly successful. And Ailes knew television. He knew everybody in the industry at that point knew that Nixon wasn't very good on television. And all Ailes did, and he did this for Bush the Elder and a number of Republican politicians, he just came in and said, look, this is the medium. This is how you have to handle the medium. And then you saw Nixon kind of loosen up a bit, had a better makeup person. And Nixon actually went on Laugh-In, the program Laugh-In, and did a Sockatoomie skit. And that was all Ailes' tutoring. So, yes, you're correct in that, Dan.
So tell me if you're aligned on this thinking that Roger Ailes for the media was the first and most successful to come in and say, look, we don't have to reach everybody. We don't have to make everybody like us. We need to carve out a slice that people are going to be more deeply engaged with, and found that to be a winning strategy and proved that to be a winning strategy. Would you credit him with that?
I don't know about that. Roger Ailes' genius was he knew who was good on television. He was like a football coach who knows what a good quarterback is. All right. And he knew who was going to get the attention of the viewers and who was not. And that is a very, very particular skill that today, in today's world, I don't know any television executives who have it, which is why you're seeing a massive flight away from all news broadcasting. But Ailes knew who was good. It was almost an instinct about him. Because as television rose in power, it was about keeping people's interest, the audience's interest. And if you look at all our icons, they were very talented people. Lucille Ball, Lucy, we told a story about her husband, Desi Arnaz, in Killing the Mob. It's amazing. Yeah. But those kinds of people, Americans were just driven, just drawn to them. And Ailes could select those kinds of people.
Well, and so whether or not you would attribute it to Ailes, would you agree that the media has shifted from this notion? And, you know, part of it is fairness doctrine, but part of it is just business. You make more money, you get more reach, you have a more engaged audience. If you pick a population of people that you want to super serve and then focus on them and not worry about the rest, would you agree that that is now a commonplace strategy?
Yes, I would agree with that. But it's even more than that. So what happened was that the huge corporations like Disney and Comcast, AT&T, Viacom, huge conglomerates, they saw the amount of money that Fox made with a presentation that was very inexpensive to produce. So they saw that Fox galvanized a certain amount of people in America, millions and millions of people. Now, you can assign different reasons why, but the bottom line was that billions with a B of dollars flowed in to the Fox News channel. And that, of course, lifted the parent company so they could do a lot of other things. Once that was established, and that was established right after 9/11, as a real firm, this is the way the industry's going. Then they all started to copy. And then it reached a crescendo of absurdity under Donald Trump, where you didn't have any fact finding at all. All you had was, we hate him. So if you hate him, you watch us, or we love him. And if you love him, you watch us. So that destroyed journalism in America, because the major corporations basically put the word out that you're going to do it this way. You're not going to look for the facts and what's really true or any of the subtleties. You're going to hate them or you're going to love them. And so that's why we're in the mess we're in right now.
Well, and I want to dig into that with you. I mean, do you really believe that this is a byproduct of the anti-Trump part of this country? Or is it possible that there is equal culpability on both sides?
I don't know culpability. I mean, all I know is I'm glad I'm out of it. I run my own independent.
Yeah, right.
I run my own independent news agency. Ailes never once told me what to say, just so you know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Never. And even when I pitched the show, The O'Reilly Factor, I said, look, I was up at Harvard at the Kennedy School, and I designed the show. Because I knew the technology was going to allow for 24 hours news at that point. Because I don't want to see it.
Well, and Bill, you're the only one that wrote your own scripts, correct?
Yes.
Is that an accurate statement? Yeah, which is very rare.
As far as I know.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
Unless they're switching it on you.
It's never been challenged.
Well, you know, we had Carl Cameron on a few months ago, and he actually said the same thing, that nobody told him what to say. But, you know, Fox gets a lot of heat. And I think, you know, part of what we're trying to do with our show and with the Media Roundtable as an initiative, as a movement, is we do want accountability on both sides. And this is my view. I believe both sides are looking out, not being introspective. And I think that that carries a lot of problems. When we're trying to, you know, we can't even agree on truth. But if everything is pushed through a narrative of the other guys are bad, we're good, they're going to take away everything we want in our lives. You know, if they're going to take away our way of life and it's all a fight for survival, how are you ever going to hear anybody and how are you ever going to hold yourself to account? And that seems to be a problem. Would you not agree?
It's a huge problem. Because the American public doesn't know what's real. They don't. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing this tour with Donald Trump. It's called a history tour. It's going to be what the deuce happened in those 4 years. It's not going to be a rally. It's not going to be fake news. It's not going to be the election was a fraud. It's not going to be any of that. It's going to, how'd you get the vaccine in 7 months? It seems to be a miracle. How'd you do it?
Listen, right? I don't know
what kind of stuff
yeah.
that we're going to do.
Well, right? So I can't imagine how you got him to agree to that. Because everybody that I know that has worked with him on anything, say that he does what he wants to do. And if he wants to talk about the fake news media, I mean, I think he put that in your statement about the tour, you know, so how, to the extent you can talk about it, did you have to, agree that the election and the disputes over the election were not going to be a factor or how, did,
no,
how does
that work?
No, we
don't
have
to agree. Not at all. If he wants to bring it up, he can bring it up. I'm going to ask him questions that are fact-based. If you Google O'Reilly Trump interviews, Dan, you will see 20 interviews.
Yeah.
All right? All fact-based interviews. That's what you're going to see live, although the stakes now are much higher because he was president for 4 years. So is there going to be any difference? The way I interview everybody is the way I'm going to interview him. And if he doesn't want to answer a question, then 17,000 people sitting right in front of him are going to see that. But my questions are going to be very crafted, very specific, very historical, and I know what I'm talking about. But the general picture here is what's happened, and I'm a good guy to talk to this about, I might tell you, Dan.
Yeah.
It's because I worked at CBS News and ABC News.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I worked at the networks for Dan Rather and Peter Jennings. I know what it used to be. And I know what it is now. And it's not even in the same hemisphere. Because now the big corporations, and I include the New York Times and Washington Post in this, and the Associated Press, they basically let the correspondents and the producers, the news gatherers, know what they want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Not what they might find out, but this is what we want to hear. Because as you said, they're supersizing their point of view to bring in a specific audience. If you go against that, you're not going to do well.
So you mentioned the New York Times. You mentioned the Washington Post. Those are some of the usual suspects. But you're the no-spin guy. Are you willing to call out any right-leaning publications for their bias or contribution to some of our polarized state?
I do it all the time. On my daily broadcast and on the radio, we have 300 radio stations. I do a Paul Harvey-esque show every day. I'll give you an example. Fauci. Okay. Yeah. So Fauci is demonized and the right mm-hmm. doesn't like Fauci, right?
Yeah.
So his emails come out and then everybody's yelling and screaming about Fauci lied. Fauci did this. Fauci did that. I read the emails. I didn't see any lies. Did you see any lies?
No.
I didn't see any. Okay. So I said, show me the lies. Now, my opinion of Anthony Fauci, he's a political guy. He does mm-hmm. what he's told to do. He's working for Trump. Trump wants him to say something. He says it. He's working for Biden. Same thing. All right. But I don't see Fauci lying. And maybe he did, but I haven't seen it yet. Now, did Fauci seed money into Wuhan? He doesn't have the power to do that. But if you listen to conservatives and right wings and some media, you'll have Fauci, you know, working hand in hand with Wuhan to get a virus all over the world. And I'm going, you don't do that unless you have incontrovertible proof. And it's not there. And I do that all the time.
Have you made a statement about the election in those terms? And I apologize for not knowing this already, but do you believe that Trump would have won as he says he did?
I analyzed the election from the data available.
Yeah.
All right. So I looked at the data available, and there are two things that beyond any reasonable doubt, there was cheating.
Mm-hmm.
William Barr said it. The attorney
sure.
general said it.
Sure.
There was.
But have we ever not had cheating in a
That's
in a
presidential exactly
election?
Right.
Yeah.
But whataboutism is really what's not in play here. OK,
yeah.
Well, what about U.S. Grant? OK.
Yeah.
There was cheating just as there was in 1960 mm-hmm. with John F. Kennedy's election.
Mm-hmm.
But did it rise to the level where the Supreme Court would say Pennsylvania got to revote. It did not. Mm-hmm. It did not. Now, is there a smoking gun somewhere? Is there a series of facts that might prove that? Maybe we'll find out with all these lawsuits against Dominion. Because remember, you're going to have to do discovery in that. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to bring in, all right, you did this, you did that. Let's see. But I always said from day one after that election, I said, I have not seen enough proof or facts that if I were a sitting Supreme Court justice, I would overturn this election. And I lost viewers for saying it. But mm-hmm. what else am I going to do? Yeah. That's the truth. It's not there.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that. And that approach, it's gone missing. Right. And I wonder, what is your perspective? You know, as you look at the challenges this country faces, how big a challenge, where does polarization rank on that list for you? Because I think they're connected.
You have two different movements. All right. You have the progressive left movement, which is now gain the sympathy of corporate media. Right? Mm-hmm. It's insane. The corporate media is cutting its own throat. But for some reason, the progressive left has gained favorable news coverage. And these are dangerous people. All right. So the Black Lives Matter Global Foundation, because of my reporting, we all know it's a Marxist organization. The three women who founded it are Marxists. They say so. Okay. Now, they use race, George Floyd, other police catastrophes. They use that, all right, to demonize the whole country, to say white supremacist country, got to dismantle everything, got to dismantle the Constitution, got to dismantle capitalism, start over. Here's a brand new, brave new world. That's what the progressive left's doing. On the other side, you have the reactionary right. And they're basically say, see, we told you about these commies. We told you what they're going to do and why they hate us white people, us Europeans. They hate us. And now they're indoctrinating our kids and they're cranking our guns and they're doing all of this stuff. So, yeah, when you're in a person who does not know very much, who doesn't follow the news, then you're hearing all of this stuff. What are you going to believe? So we have a country that's being misled by both sides. And that's so dangerous, I can't even describe it.
Well, and so how do you walk that back? How do we walk that back?
Well, look, it's already happening and there's a backlash against the media. Because, I mean, even if you hate Trump, you know that the fix was in for Joe Biden. You know. You have mm-hmm. to know, mm-hmm. right? So the backlash is that people aren't reading newspapers as much as they used to, and they're not watching television news as much as they used to. And it's big numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, we've seen those declines, 30-40%. Right. It's problematic.
Right. Right. Yeah. And so that backlash is happening as we speak. The other thing is that you have to try in some way to convince people that facts and what really happened is important to their lives. Now, I've made some great inroads here. We got 18 million copies of my books in print. That's a hell of a lot of books.
That's a lot of books, yeah.
And they're all fact-based books, all right, about America. So you read all 10 of my killing books, you know about this country. So there's an appetite for it.
Let me talk to you about what the Media Roundtable really is. It's not just a podcast, it's a movement. Negative polarization is making all of us miserable. We've talked about how 80% of Americans now believe that the country is falling apart. And meanwhile, private companies are the most trusted institutions in America, while trust in media has never been lower. And the irony here is that it's these same private companies that actually make news media possible through sponsorship. So the Media Roundtable joins together media and marketers and mobilizes them to promote truth and civility in journalism. We're committed to increasing advertiser support for content that shares our values of clarity, fairness, truth, tolerance, respect, and de-escalation. By the way, you can learn more about this when you read the pledge in full at MediaRoundtable.com. So if you're in media or marketing, you can make a powerful difference in helping to bind the wounds of our fractured nation without compromising your business goals or your brand values. Media Roundtable is here to help by providing resources and support for our members every step of the way. We want you to get involved. All you need to do is visit MediaRoundtable.com and sign the pledge right now.
Well, let me tell you what we're trying to do, because I think that, you know, depolarizing this country, like how are we going to compete in this world if we're too busy fighting each other all day, if we think other Americans are our biggest problem, right? What we're trying to do from where we sit is we're trying to get the advertisers, the sponsors, to pay attention to where they are advertising and what content they are supporting and how that measures on truth and civility. And if you're positioning information so that you're saying, here is my opinion and that person is the problem versus this issue is the problem, if you're personalizing it, that's bad. And we want advertisers to put less dollars behind people that are pushing us apart, because right now we live in an attention economy and everybody, there's too much money to be made in exploiting our differences. But it's very, very hard. And I don't know how you get this to the creator level, since everybody's a journalist now. I mean, what do you think about social media? And is that something that should be regulated by the government? What is the answer for the role that is playing in misinformation, false information, and polarization?
Well, it's going to be regulated by the media, by the government. It's already happened in Florida. So if you live in Florida, you're a citizen.
Is that
going to stick,
though? Is that enforceable?
Yeah. I mean, you want to bring a suit against a social media company in Florida, you can't. Mm-hmm. And that's going to cost them. And if the Republicans win back Congress and a Republican president defeats whoever runs on the Democratic side next time, there's going to be legislation against these powerful media companies that are banning people, banishing people on a, you know, a series of regulations that nobody even knows about. Right. Because these companies are so powerful and they control commerce. It's a commerce situation. So that's coming. And if I were the CEOs of those companies, I'd wise up fast. And I'd say, look, we're not going to allow obscenity. We're not going to allow criminality. We're not going to allow anything that would hurt you directly. But we're going to have a forum here. We can put all kinds of warnings and bells and whistles or whatever you want to do. But to start to ban people and knock them out for what they're saying, that's not going to hold much longer in this country. I can guarantee you that. As far as your campaign to convince sponsors to be responsible, I wish you the best of luck. If you can do it, I am right behind you.
Well, thank you. We can use the help, and we need it from everybody, because I think that there are some journalistic integrity principles that both sides could agree on if they didn't feel like they had to align with people they despise to do that. I think that people generally want the same thing. You know, one of the things we talk about on this show a lot is, you know, what are the standards that a journalist should follow? And we've talked to some serious journalists, but you really paved the way. I mean, you really were part of a revolution in opinion journalism. And I think that you carried in as a journalist some of the best practices of playing devil's advocate against your own argument, acknowledging when the side that you might align with on one thing, you want to call on something else. I don't see that happening a lot. What should be the rules for an opinion journalist or a piece of opinion journalism?
Well, it should all be fact-based. So if you're going to write an opinion in a newspaper, on an op-ed, or even an editorial, you've got to line up things that have happened that you can prove they happened. That's number one. And number two, you can't be told what to say and do. And now that's what, as we discussed, is going on. But, you know, I'm a classically trained journalist. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a who, what, when, where, and why. That's where we start. All right. And then we say, all right, well, this person says this and that person says that. And I go back and I get primary source material for what I'm looking at, not, you know, the Atlantic magazine or this or, you know, really on the ground stuff. And it's much harder to do that, Dan. It takes longer to do it. It's very labor intensive. But that's the way that I roll. And I have been very successful in my life doing that, because I think Americans, they catch on that this is not an operation designed to deceive us. I don't want to deceive anybody. I'm not a party guy. I don't care about political parties at all. I want what's best for the country.
Do you think Washington was right in warning us against political factions and parties?
George Washington saw that power could be abused, and that he was smart enough to understand that in a developing nation, the people with the most money were going to have the most power. So I wrote a book called Killing England. And I think if you really want to know George Washington, you read that book.
Okay.
Because I tell you good and bad about him. Okay. Mm-hmm. But he had a good vision of how power could be abused. And it has been throughout our whole history. Power has been abused. And it's the journalist's role, if you're going to get into this profession, to stand up to the powerful. But we don't have that now, because the powerful sign your checks. And that is the big change in journalism.
Yeah, that is the problem. Now back to the corporation. So now, in full disclosure, I have an ad agency, so I'm paid by corporations. However, the corporations that pay me and the CEOs that I know, they're doing the best that they can, but it's complex and they have a lot of new expectations on them. You've probably seen the push toward stakeholder capitalism as compared to shareholder capitalism, and the idea that, okay, now everybody's going to do well by doing good. We have corporate social governance standards that we need to meet and report, and it's not all about the bottom line for them. But as a byproduct of that, we see very controversial issues coming up in the news, and then there is societal pressure on companies to make a statement on political issues. Do you agree that they should?
I think that's stupid. I think any CEO who wants to get into making woke statements is a blanket moron.
What if it is the opposite of woke statements? Should they make any statements?
Well, I mean, look, are these PhDs in political science we're talking about here? So my advice to all of these people, the CEOs, whatever it may be, is button it unless you really know what you're talking about and unless you are willing to commit to improving the situation for everybody.
Bill, I appreciate that. And I think it's a great time to wrap, because I know you're out of time. But thank you so much for covering all of this in 45 minutes. And can you just share with our listeners ways that they can follow up and get your book, sign up for your tour, watch your show, listen to your show? Where do you send them?
BillO'Reilly.com. Very simple. My name, one word, Bill O'Reilly. You don't have to put the apostrophe in. And then in that area, we have tons of stuff for free. You can see my columns and my commentaries and this and that. If you become a premium member, you can watch me every night on television. We do the No Spin News for an hour. And then the books, Father's Day coming up, great book for dad or granddad. Doesn't matter if he's liberal, conservative, if he likes history, if he likes exciting reads, this is it. Killing the Mob and the other 9 killing books. So BillO'Reilly.com is where it is. We'll have information about the Trump shows. Should you want to attend, you'll be able to do it easy through us. Ticketmaster has, obviously in Lauderdale and Orlando and Dallas and Houston, you can easily get tickets. But that's a place where I think people should go. And again, you don't have to agree with me. I'm not asking anybody to agree with me. I think you consider what we say and how we say it, and you make up your own mind, but I think you'll enjoy it. And I want to appreciate you, Dan. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. We need more people like you to get, you know, this country civil again. All right. Make America great again. No, make America civil again. That's what we need. And thanks
Amen.
Again for having me on.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate
okay.
it. This show is dedicated to advancing our mission of mobilizing marketers to promote truth and civility in journalism. We value truth, clarity, fairness, respect, de-escalation, and tolerance, and we invite you to engage with us at MediaRoundtable.com. If you found this show helpful and you're committed to our cause, please follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. It's always free, and if you're a marketer looking for support to live this out, we can get you in touch with our agency, Oxford Road, by visiting oxfordroad.com and subscribe to our weekly newsletter, The Influencer. Special thanks to Bianca, Kyle, Jennifer, and the team at Podcast One. Keep coming back.